You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema with Big Willie and the Samurai, bringing class to trash since 1977.
Welcome to another episode of The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. I am Large William, and across the border from me in the Keystone State is the one and only Hot Toddy.
Hello, hello. How's everybody doing?
Better than our Skype shenanigans this morning, I can imagine. Just to pull back the curtain, Skype's been very temperamental.
Sketchy.
Yeah, very sketchy lately, and caused us a lot of grief and stress when we're already kind of stacked up. Sammy cannot be with us. He was in the midst of saving the rec center. He had a breakdancing contest in Taipei, Taiwan, of all places. The breakdance called the B-boy culture is alive and well in Taiwan. And
I didn't know that.
Yes, unfortunately, so is corporate villainy. So he's got a pop and lock. Far from home to
gotta do the worm.
Yeah, you gotta do the worm, man. Gotta show his worm, maybe.
Oh, buddy, you might
like that snake. So this episode is programmed by both of us, as you've come to know over the past 8 years plus. Actually, it's programmed by you guys and by Todd, I should say, in a roundabout way. So Todd, being the gentleman he is, said, "Do you want a program?" And I said, "Well, do you want a program?" We kind of just tried to out-nice each other, and ultimately he picked the film. And then I picked a bunch of films, and I threw it up in the group to let you guys pick. I do also want to say, before I forget, to say to you and to our other friends, I'm sure I'll say it online, but to our listeners, wishing all of our friends in America a very happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Now, whether you subscribe to the point of origin of the holiday and what that means or not, I think, you know, to be able to spend time with family at the dinner table with loved ones is something that is sort of a universal thing regardless of point of origin with the holiday.
Indeed.
So, yes, hope it's a good and safe one, and there's lots of food and lots of stretchy pants. Zubaz are best this time of year. So there you have it. Now, without further ado, let's get into what we're covering this week.
Okay.
Todd programmed a film that I'd never seen. I'd meant to see for some time. It wasn't, I wouldn't say right in my wheelhouse, but, you know, it was one that, being a horror guy, I had wanted to see for some time. It's 1981's Roy Ward Baker Jam, The Monster Club.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so I saw Madhouse for the first time last year, the year before. Kind of, I mean, not similar, but kind of similar in some ways, reverential kind of meta look at icons of the horror genre.
Yeah, well, Madhouse, I haven't seen. It's been what I've been meaning to.
Oh man, that would have been kind of a cool double then. Madhouse is really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, Madhouse is cool, man. I really dug it.
Nice.
Yeah, I think it was last year, maybe, or the year before I saw it. But yeah, it's a good one for sure.
Well, I think you did that Midnight Ride, didn't you?
Yeah, I probably did, man. I probably did.
Well, you know, Roy Ward Baker, he's been around the whole Hammer kind of dealy Bob there. He's the guy who gave us
Asylum.
Asylum, Madhouse, Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde.
Mother to Knock.
He gave us Quatermass in the Pit.
Oh, which I've never seen.
It's outstanding. It's my favorite of the Quatermass films.
Oh, wow. Can I confess?
Seven Brothers Meet Dracula.
Seven Brothers Meet Dracula?
Oh, yeah. That's the Shaw Brothers slash Hammer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Right, right. Okay.
And Vault of Horror, which would be kind of in the same wheelhouse as this and Madhouse and Asylum.
Yeah, no, it's too bad it wasn't directed by, what's his name there? Jonathan Kaplan. It could have been a different kind of Seven Brothers Meet Dracula. That would have been cool, man.
That would have been all right.
Yeah, it would have been cool. Or Seven Brothers Meet Blackula, maybe. Who knows?
Ooh. Yeah, that would have been nice. If you get William Marshall.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, Roy Ward Baker definitely been around. He was British, I guess.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, when you think of that era of when I think of that era of horror films, I think of three guys basically: Freddie Francis, Terrence Fisher, and Roy Ward Baker. I mean, there are others, obviously, but
sure,
those are the ones that always kind of stand out because they were so heavily linked with the whole Hammer deal, the whole British kind of invasion of horror.
And the Vault
and this
of
is kind of like no, go ahead, yeah, Vault of Horror, yeah.
Vault of Horror is a really fun one. I coincidentally did cover on the Midnight Ride a couple years ago.
Yep.
I
was just going to say this one to me, the Monster Club is kind of like almost like a last gasp kind of thing.
Yeah.
In many ways, because it's very much late cycle of that whole anthology deal. And now I know that whenever I think of this, I always think of Midnight Hour, even though I'm pretty sure Midnight Hour is not an anthology film. Correct. I haven't seen it yet.
Correct. It's not an anthology.
Yeah, for some reason or another, I always link the two in my head.
Midnight Army and the made for TV one.
The made for TV,
yeah, cool. Which is a high recommend for me. But in some ways, I guess I could see linking them because there's kind of this cobbled together kind of love of monsters of a bygone era.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, exactly. It's that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, that would make sense for sure, man. For sure. So that's cool. Very nice. And of course, Roy Ward Baker. In good company, a lot of fine three-name directors out there.
And by the way, not related to Joe Don Baker.
Sadly for him,
in case you were, yeah,
boss.
Right? Yeah. Joe Don would hit him with the flop sweat.
Yeah, he sure would, man. Hit him with that stick. Man, Roy Ward, good thing he didn't. Well, because he didn't, Roy Ward Baker lived to be 93 years old.
How about that?
He died on my wedding anniversary.
Did he really?
Yeah, October 5th, 2010.
Lord.
That's not the year we got married, but we've been married for 3 years then. Hmm. Interesting. So we go from him to another three-name director who was prolific in across the globe, Nem Nai Choi, who, a favorite of mine. We've covered films of his on the show before. Doesn't quite get enough credit. This was one that I threw up to the group along with, like I said, a bunch of others. I've been meaning to cover it for ages and ages. And, you know, just that's the way it goes. You know,
yeah, this one ran away with it.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I'm trying to look here at what we've covered of his. The Cat, I think. Did we cover The Cat?
I think you did. Did you cover – did he Riccio?
Yeah, he did Riccio, which is – you know, what he's probably most known for.
Yeah.
Oh, I think we did Men from the Gutter.
Men from the Gutter,
City, I think we did. I think, which is a tremendous film. Tremendous film.
Wait, which one?
Brothers from the Walled City. Yeah, it's very cool. Seventh Curse, I did.
Yeah.
The Peacock King, I don't think we've ever done, but I've always meant to do.
Peacock King's good, yeah.
It's very good, yeah.
Yeah,
very
the
good.
The sequel, yeah, a little bit less, but...
I've never seen it. Peacock King's pretty bonkers. This is, you know, talk about a guy that's pretty diverse. Nem Nai Choi, known mostly for his Riccio, but I did The Cat, actually, on another Midnight Ride. Like, yeah, I did because... Yeah, no, I did. So, he's a guy, didn't do a ton of films. For a Hong Kong director, 13, that's not overly prolific. He did shoot, or lens, 24 films. So, very interesting. We'll get into talking about him as well. But before we get into those, what have you been watching lately?
Alrighty. Let's see. Started off, I don't remember if the last time we talked I spoke about Phoenix, the 2014 film. About the woman who she was a concentration camp survivor. She's horribly disfigured. She gets redone, and then she goes after. Well, she doesn't go after. She reunites with her husband to find out if he had turned her in. And it was really, really good.
I love this film.
Yeah, it was. I was really impressed. It's a slow burn, but man, when you hit that ending, it's a knockout. Very, very high recommend.
It's an instant, we should say.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I went from that to Phantasm IV, Oblivion, which is, I'm going to say, just not my favorite of the Phantasm films, but it was good. It gets a little bit weirder than some of the other ones, which is kind of saying something. But it also feels, you know, it very much is a Coscarelli thing.
I don't know if I've seen 4. I think I've seen only 1, 2, 3.
Up until a short time ago, I'd only seen the first two, because me and franchises are very short, have always been very short lived. I think the most I've ever seen in a franchise was the first 6 Friday the 13th, and that's saying something.
Todd's more of a part time lover kind of guy.
I really am. Yeah, I you know, what can you do?
Dine and dash.
Ding dong ditch. ding dong especially. This was good. I mean, it's nice to see how the series kind of, you could say, progresses. But yeah, I'll leave it at that. Rewatched The Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3. If you want to come see me, then you pay a fee. Nice. If you like that little reference. 1974, Walter Matthau, Robert Shaw, Martin Balsam, Jerry Stiller. A fantastic cast, one of the best caper movies going in the 70s, and yet another the great examples of how diverse Walter Matthau could be, because he kind of plays it straight in this. I mean, he still has that humor, that Walter Matthau kind of smirky wry,
Yeah.
But it still it plays out fantastically, and plus it's got a great score by David Shire, I want to say. I don't know if I'm getting that correctly. When you first hear it, when it starts up, you're thinking to yourself it's Lalo Schifrin, but it's not. So just yet another reason to watch a great movie.
Also on Instant, I believe.
I don't know. I DVR'd it off of TCM.
I love that. That film is maybe, and I might be just, I could say in 5 minutes, fuck, once I start to really think about this statement, but probably a top 3 to 5 like heist film of mine. Like, I really love it.
Nice.
Really love it. And the remake, it works. Not so much.
Yeah, the remake I've seen parts of. It's just
not terrible, but it's, you know.
Yeah, there's better. There's much.
There's
better.
The original.
Yeah, exactly. caught up with the 1961's Pigs and Battleships, yes. Shohei Imamura, and this was another really good one. It's a film which is. Excuse me, I had to cough there for a second.
Are you at doctor's office by any chance?
Yeah, buddy. No, I test myself.
That her vengeance. Office.
I'm palpating things right now as we speak. the best is when he sticks. Never mind. Okay. Anyway, I like to dirty talk my doctor sometimes. I'm just saying. Blow kisses.
I'm sure he appreciates
slow kisses from the mud whistle.
You wink at him.
Yeah, in more ways than one. I got my green eyes and my brown eye winking. So anyway, this is for me, it's a very sprawling film. I mean, it's all over the place, and the hardest thing I had with watching it is that it was difficult for me to keep track of everything that's going on, which even if even if you're not paying attention, well, if you're not paying attention, I mean, you're going to get completely lost. But because there is just a ton of stuff going on. But it's very much in that mold of what was happening in the 60s with some of the filmmakers over there in Japan. But don't get me wrong, I'm not, you know, denigrating the film. I think it's a fantastic achievement. And by the time you get to the end, it's a kind of downbeat. but it's still hopeful. And it's a really tough trick to pull off, but Imamura does it, and he does it very, 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 very well. I'm not 100% sure this is going to be on my top 30s for the year, but it's definitely in the running. Just to play coy right there. Moved on to Hitchcock Truffaut, the documentary for 2015. And this was really good, really, really good. It's not so much concerned with the meeting of the two, although it is, as much as it's about, you know, talking about film and the way that Hitchcock influenced other filmmakers. And it just kind of the Hitchcock Truffaut interview is a springboard for these guys to speak about, you know, kind of include themselves in the conversation more or less. And very, very interesting for that. If you love filmmaking and, you know, if you're not into to Hitchcock, this would be a great way to get you interested in there, because you really begin to understand exactly what the appeal was and what why it is that the man is so highly regarded.
I love seeing stuff like that, pro on pro, just a mutual respect and reverence. I mean, that stuff really is really cool to see.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you get guys like Fincher, Scorsese, of course. Olivier Assayas. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Yeah, guys like them, they all, you know, chime in on it. It's a very good documentary. And if nothing else, it's made me want to – I mean, I have the audio from the interviews, but now it made me want to pick up the book, which sadly I never purchased. So moved on from there to a rewatch of Pumpkinhead, 1988, Stan Winston. And this is still a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous monster movie. One of my favorites of the 80s. I love the design of Pumpkinhead. I love the way, you know, Winston really pulled it off, especially coming as a first time film. And there's a lot going on in this. It's got an emotional impact. And, you know, of course, everything else plays out very, very well. And it's a very... It has young people in it, but it's not a film that's geared for young people. I mean, it's a mature monster movie, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, the same cannot be said for the sequel, which I also watched, which was just a fucking turd, and I'll leave it at that. I caught up with Remember from 2015, Christopher Plummer, Martin Landau.
Oh, man, I saw this at TIFF with my mom.
Jürgen Prochnow. Now, yeah, oh yeah. This was another one. It's tense throughout, because you're never sure. It's almost like Memento with old people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because every time the guy wakes up, he has to remember everything and, you know, read this letter that he was given, because he's looking to find the officer, the German, the Nazi officer, SS guy, who murdered his and Landau's family. And again, you get that absolute gut punch ending.
Man,
which,
that fucking ending. I got to be honest. Yeah. I totally got like blindsided.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But it's tension throughout, because you're just – every time that this guy wakes up, he has to remember everything. And you're like, is he going to fuck up? Is he going to get caught? Is he going to get – because the whole thing is that he kind of escapes from the nursing home where he's at.
You know, a couple minor gripes I have with the film, very minor – I wish there was more Bruno Ganz.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very short appearance from Ganz, yeah.
Yeah, very short appearance from Ganz. And I felt like the one – go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I think that you're going to be going there as well, but I'll let you say it first.
The one scene that I felt like was a misstep to me was almost cartoonish in how kind of ugly / evil the character was the – I think it was like the uncle from Breaking Bad. Or like the brother-in-law of Walter White or something. I don't know. I only watched a few episodes, but...
Well, you're talking about the Stady episode, the Stady scene. State police guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That got a bit cartoonish to me.
Exactly. Yeah, very much.
But,
yeah.
And, I mean, I think he was a little too on-the-nose cartoonish, but...
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Otherwise, a solid, solid film, like an honorable mention for me. You get to see a lot of really good actors. And I have to say, and I've said this before when I talked about this film... If this film has a commentary track, I would highly recommend people watch it, because I had the pleasure of seeing it at TIFF, hearing it spoken about with the producer and with Egoyan, and it really enhanced my appreciation for the film. Like the difficulty in casting German actors of a certain age in these roles and the reluctance of some, and, you know, working with Plummer, and really, really enriched the performance. You know, not an all-time film, but I, for me, it was solid, like 7.5 territory.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's about where I came in on it. Yeah.
Cool.
Follow that up with Krampus from 2015, and I got to say that I was impressed with this. I really enjoyed it. It's got a heavy Joe Dante vibe going on. It's got great practical effects and a lot of them. The characters, they're the ones that are assholes, and the ones that aren't. And it's got it still fleshes them out. It still gives you characterization that the more than they're more than cardboard cutouts. And it also has a nice – I thought that the ending was going to kind of go one way, and it didn't, and I was happy about that. I was happy that it it stuck to it stuck to what it said it was going to do. So, yeah, no, I really love this. I know that guys like our boy Chris from over at Cult of Muscle calls this he says if this movie smelled, it would smell like butt ass, but I would have to disagree with that person.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. I was kind of on the fence about watching it, but
I liked it. I liked it a lot. I think I came in at 7.5 on it.
Nice.
Maybe a little bit lower.
I can't see myself coming in below like a 6, 6.5 thing, because you're usually the more miserly of the games of the two of us. So if you come in 7.5, I can't see myself,
I would see you coming in around 7 on it, maybe a little bit less. 6.75, I say, would be the lowest you'd go. It would be my estimation.
Oh, wow, nice. I'm going to have to watch it this Christmas.
There you go, yeah. And then caught up with Danny Boyle's Steve Jobs, 2015. And again, I didn't expect much more than some decent performances, but it actually is very visually interesting. And it's very interestingly structured in that it's not a standard biopic. It's basically takes place over three launches that Jobs was at, and the people who in his life he has to deal with as each of these launches is just about to take off. Again, very, very strong performances and a nice score. And it kind of missteps a little bit in the last 10 minutes, kind of making – like they kind of have to squeeze in that Jobs is kind of this quasi-messianic figure, which – and, to kind of wrap everything up, the big emotional beat they have to wrap up. And that kind of was a misstep for me. I don't know how true it is, but maybe it is. But either way, outside of that, though, I mean, this is a very, very good movie. Solid, solid stuff.
I was going to cram it. I didn't. I love Fassbender. I think he's arguably the best working actor today, or can run with anyone at the very least. The subject matter didn't overly appeal to me, but I
still... Me neither, because I've never had any interest in Steve Jobs whatsoever.
No, me neither.
None, zero. And I've never bought anything. Well, no, that's not true. I have an iPod. But outside of that, I mean... that sort of thing didn't really – it doesn't appeal to me on the surface. And Kate Winslet is absolutely outstanding in this as well.
Oh, nice.
I mean, everybody is. Everybody is. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was going to go dirty there, but I'm not going to. Anyway. And then I got these two films for the week, a film for the blog, and then I caught up with George Axelrod's 1966 Lord Love a Duck, Tuesday Weld,
Ooh, we
Roddy McDowell.
We covered this in the show.
Did you?
Yeah.
I really like this.
Yeah, it was an interesting.
I really like this, man. I was impressed. I mean, it's kind of got that groovy Hep kind of thing going on, but it's for a satire. I mean, it keeps it pretty real with some of the stuff going on.
Yeah, it does.
And the ending is it's kind of a melancholy, bittersweet kind of thing that it's got going on. Roddy McDowell, of course, is always awesome.
He is. Yeah.
Tuesday Weld is an actress who, to me, has never really held that great an appeal. I mean, I think she's very, very talented, but her being in a film alone is just not enough to get me to want to watch it. But this also has great performances by guys like Harvey Korman, and the fantastic Ruth Gordon, who shows up in there doing a Ruth Gordon thing. So yeah, no, I was heavily impressed with this, a lot more than I expected it to be. I expected it to be kind of half of what it is, but then it throws enough lefts at you that you're not seeing the right coming. So yeah, no, I would recommend this one, and I think this one is another one. Well, this week there was a lot of these past 2 weeks there was a lot of them that that could very much be in contention for top 30 for me.
Nice. You know, it's great when you have those weeks, eh, where it's like you can't miss, and there's other weeks where it's like, fuck, like,
Jesus,
man,
Christ, I'm never going to get 30.
Like, it's like a minefield of turds everywhere.
That's funny because I got to walk my dog in one of those every day. yeah, that's it for me.
Nice. All right, let me see what I've been getting into then. It's been, man, you know, as we've talked about, it seems to be the soup du jour every day for like the past year, but just I can't find time for jack shit, man. My kids are getting older. Yeah. They're up later. I'm getting more tired earlier. I'm taking two trains kind of going in opposite directions, right? Sports stuff, familial obligations, on and on it goes. But I have watched a few things, especially in the interest of time here. I'll try to keep it. I've watched a few things. I think, did I talk about the Netflix produced documentary 13th?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, I'll watch this. It's a tough watch. The fine folks over at Married with Clickers did an episode on it very recently. Go over and listen to them. It's a tough watch. Talking about the privatization of the penal system, of what ails America, and the world over, frankly. Western world, I guess. It's a tough watch, but it's Ava DuVernay, really great filmmaker, talking about an urgent issue. So I don't want to say too much about it, but a high recommend for me. It'll probably make my top 30.
Okay,
the
cool.
Early footage, especially when they're showing stuff from like D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, and just some of the news footage of just appalling. I can never wrap my head around man's capacity for cruelty. I just can't. Then I watched The Ballad of Narayama.
Ah.
This fucking blew my weave back.
Really?
Man, I really...
This is from when?
1958.
That early, okay.
Yeah, it's in color, too. It's stunning. I loafed up. It's a stunning film. High recommend. I was trying to get in as much in on Criterion before... they bailed on Hulu.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. The Japanese films, family dramas, just, you know, especially I'm close to my mom. And, really good stuff. Really poignant, beautiful. High recommend. Right. Definite.
You're gonna have to hit up the Somorozu on there before they go.
I know. Oh, they're gone.
Are they?
Sadly. But I'm going to try to get in Backdoor Filmstruck. And I got a free backdoor 2-week trial, but they're not on like Roku or anything right now, so I'm gonna have to watch desktop, which is tough, but you know, first world problems. I do gotta get into more Ozu. I've only seen like 3 or 4. I gotta rectify that. Next up, I watched Sawdust and Tinsel. I'd never even heard of this.
Me neither.
Unfortunately, I had this film had the misfortune of being watched on election night in America. right as I started to see the way the polls were going, which meant this film really got the short shrift for me.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was a fascinating film. It's an early Bergman, 1953, about a traveling troupe of circus performers and about some domestic woes amongst some of the troupe, financial hardships.
And this was a Hulu as well?
This was on Hulu. Sawdust and Tinsel, a really, really strong film. Like, you know, like a solid 7.5 type film. Beautifully shot, black and white. Harriet Anderson is one of the leads in it. Really good stuff. Really good stuff. Then I had the pleasure of going to see 1982's John Carpenter masterpiece, The Thing, on the big screen.
One of the best.
With Scott Clickers of Married with Clickers fame, Christian Bates Hardy and his lovely wife of Good Movies for Bad People fame. Our dear friend Vishnu, and as well as Courtney's brother and his girlfriend. We went out for drinks and for a bite to eat and went to see this on the big screen. It was serendipitous that it was playing the night they were in town, so it was lovely. I wish the night could have went into the wee hours, but I had to work 15 hours the next day, and they had stuff going on, and whatnot, but it was great to see it on the big screen. The sound design, I have an even bigger appreciation for now. Keith David's my guy. I mean, Kurt's great, obviously, but, you know, I love Keith David. It's funny to see the Doctor's nose ring.
Copper,
I never noticed this until the Blu-ray came out.
Yep. Well, I always thought that, yeah, I always did think that he had a nose ring, and it took me a while, multiple viewings, to finally be like, no, that fucking guy hasn't – it's not a booger. He's got a nose ring, man.
It was so bizarre for the time.
Yeah, really. So bizarre. Especially for an older guy.
Yeah, for an older dude, man. Really, really bizarre. But what can I say that hasn't been said? It is a masterpiece. I love the ending. I got chills at the ending, and I got chills throughout the film, again, because the sound design, the cinematography, Morricone's score is tremendous. Even if it is him doing Carpenter a little bit, but it's man, that theme is, and that original poster, I think, might be one of the most perfect posters in cinema history.
Oh yeah,
I really adore it, and it's too bad Scream. I think it's Scream Factory put out the blue,
yes,
which I've heard good things about, but you can't top that original, man. Don't even try. Like, just go with the original, unless they couldn't for some reason for legal rights. But you know, finally, I watched Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. Watch this with the family. We're kind of waist deep in the Potterverse. My kids wanted to see Trolls. My wife and I convinced them not to. And I'm really thankful that we did, because I really, really adored Fantastic Beasts.
Nice.
Man, this film was, I loved it. It was excellent. Uniformly well acted. Eddie Redmayne's a guy that, I have to be honest, I would kind of roll my eyes when I'd see him in film, because I felt like he was – I'd never seen him in anything that I can recall, but I felt like he was just one of these guys that was like totally trying to cop Oscars, you know, and I was like, fuck him, man, you know, but I got to give it up. He's wonderful in the film. Catherine Waterston, an actress I'm not a huge fan of, is very good in the film. Alison Sudol, who I'd never seen before, she's very charming and cute in the film, kind of a blonde kind of bombshell. And what's his name here? I got to find him in the film, because he was really fun. Colin Farrell is the heavy in the film. Ezra Miller's good in the film, who people would recognize from – he did the film with Tilda Swinton.
Yeah. Well, he's also the Flash in the DC movie universe.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I don't think that's the greatest – I don't think that's the greatest
casting choice.
Yeah.
He seems a little too dark to be –
Well, it just seems a little too, I don't know.
So,
no, just like wispy.
Yeah, maybe so.
I mean, the Flash isn't known for being, well, we're getting a field now.
that seems like an odd choice. And I got to give it up to Dan Fogler, who's wonderful in the film.
Dan Fogler. He was from Balls of Fury. The guy from Balls of Fury?
Yes, okay. He's so good in the film. He's so fun in the film.
I like him. No,
he's really good, and he's really likable. The chemistry amongst the cast is great. It takes place, I want to say, like... post-World War I, pre-World War II, wonderful production design. It almost feels like a high-budget, younger audience version of what's the Fred Ward detective one?
Cast a Deadly Spell. Yeah.
It kind of feels like that a little bit. Like, it's like this world with like speakeasies and magic and the occult. And I really enjoyed it, man. I really liked it. Really liked it. So. High recommend for...
Or even like Lord of Illusion.
Yeah, for sure, man. Which I think is better than people remember it being. Like,
oh, I loved it.
Yeah, it's a
good film. Okay, I wouldn't say loved it, but I thought it was just rock solid.
Yeah, definitely, man. Definitely.
One of my favorites from Barker.
And there's some nice nods. I mean, I haven't read the Potter books, but there's some nice nods when they talk about Hogwarts and Dumbledore and, you know, a few kind of little nods to the Potter fans. But no, my kids loved it. We adored it. I might have liked it more than anyone in my family, really. So I can't wait to see. I think they're doing 5 films. So, yeah, good stuff, man. Let's take a short break. Come back. Get into... we're going to pass the velvet rope and get into Dat Monster Club. We will be right back. We'll be right back. because the monster.
With the sack.
Yeah, with the sack. With the snooker balls and the pantyhose. More ways than one. Yeah, 1981 is the Monster Club. So do you want to synopsize this and you want me to lead on it?
Whatever you want to do is fine with me.
Let's do that, but I'd also like to hear why you picked this film.
Okay, what do you want first?
I want you to tell me why you picked it.
Okay, I wanted to pick it because it's a film that I had seen many, many moons ago, and number one, I wanted to revisit it, and number two, I think it's one of those things where you just want to hear more about this style of movie, because usually we either get, you know, and not us, but, you know, in general, a lot of what you get is just really, really dumb stuff or really, really dark, brooding stuff when it comes to monsters and that sort of thing. And this movie is really always was to me just a massive celebration of it. And I think that's – I think you're going to be hearing that that sentiment a lot, certainly as I talk about it. And that's pretty much the general reason. And plus, you guys had never covered it, and I wanted to see what you thought about it. As far as the synopsis, basically, Vincent Price is a vampire. He puts the bite on John Carradine and then invites him to the local monster club.
Being
the true gentleman that he is. He invites him, you know, after you – well, you know, you got to fuck him before you take him out to dinner sometimes. and then you – so he takes him to the monster club where there's, you know, a lot of the hip young monsters hang out. And as Price introduces Carradine to all the different sorts of monsters that there are, and we get three little vignettes to illustrate, you know, the different ones. And I don't know if I mentioned that Carradine is a horror novelist.
Yes,
so,
he is.
That's about it.
Cool. All right. Yeah, so I'd never seen this. I'd meant to, like I said, for some time, being a big fan of Price, Carradine's solid, and Pleasance is the Pleasance. I don't mean that disparagingly, certainly. he's the chief of the B-Squad, thereby.
The M'Lady Squad.
The M'Lady. Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ!
He gives it. He doesn't go as full
His
filter.
Pure evil.
Yeah, he doesn't get but, to really fucking get off the chain too much in this. Which
no, not as much as you would think. Yeah,
not as much. As you
although, think. Although he does eat up what scenery he can.
Yes, yes, the few crumbs he's given, he eats it up. So yeah, we already talked about Roy Ward Baker as a filmmaker. Interesting filmography, certainly. And you talked about the cast. You know, Price, Pleasance, Carradine, Stuart Whitman, the black hole of charisma that is Stuart Whitman, who's oddly more charming in this than I'm accustomed to seeing him. The wonderful, ravishing Britt Ackland.
Throwing bricks.
From bricks. Oh man, that could be a crass joke, but I won't.
Shit in a brick.
Yeah, but she's got quite the mom do in this one. But
oh yeah.
You know what? I didn't realize this was a anthology.
I did
not realize it. So.
And also in the cast, for those who want to know, is Patrick McGee, who's a perennial British weirdo. And Simon Ward, who's the British Alain Delon.
Man, I'm glad you got that note, because that was one of my notes.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of my notes. Anthony Steele, great great name for a different kind of acting. That's for
oh,
sure.
Oh, yeah.
Anthony Steele. Incredible. Or even Fran Fullenwider.
Fullenwider.
And she does play a buxom. Her credit is Buxom Beauty.
Nice.
Self-fulfilling prophecy. So yeah, you know, this Destiny. Is 80. What was that?
Destiny.
Destiny. Yeah, Johnny Destiny turns on the radio. this is 81, like you said. This is like definitely when all of these filmmakers, all of these actors, and this kind of film was in the rearview mirror. So it's nice to see stuff like this because it's handled with a certain kind of a gentle reverence. It's almost, it's very in a way, it's kind of innocent and bittersweet to see a film like this on the screen. By this time, you were into, you know, a lot of heavy nudity and sort of sleaze and, you know, slashers were just kind of really hitting their stride. You were a few years away from Nightmare on Elm Street, but things were things had changed. The landscape of horror had changed, and monsters were not the soup du jour anymore.
Passé.
They were passé, right? I think, not to get into too much, you know, subtext or analysis of the genre, but I think what was happening in the world at this point, you know, you saw more man-based monsters than you saw sort of creature-based monsters. but there's, as Vincent Price says, there are vampires, werewolves, ghouls, among other things. And we get to the Monster Club, and there's some amazing masks. But what wouldn't be amazing would be dancing in these masks.
Oh, yeah.
Anyone who's about, you know, 30-plus can probably appreciate having coin slots for eyes in a mask, maybe like a straw hole for a mouth. Cumbersome doesn't even begin to describe it. Imagine drinking a drink in one of those masks.
Be a lot of straws.
Be a lot of dribbling down your fucking lapel, too.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
wouldn't the inside of those masks probably fucking stank. Oh, by the end of the night, between the sweat and the booze.
Yeah, terrible. Terrible. The film, thankfully, by this time, too, you know, because we look at a lot of the Italian maestros like Fulci and Lenzi and stuff, and their budgets were really starting to dwindle by this time. But this does never, it never feels cheap to me. Like, it doesn't feel that way to me, at least.
It feels on a budget, but it does not feel cheap, no.
Yes.
It still handles itself with a certain level
grace.
Of dignity. Yeah,
dignity,
grace, yeah.
Yes, it's almost like an older English gentleman, you know, he's... And that kind of works, you know, fittingly.
Well-spoken, Will.
Yes.
I plan on doing a lot of Vincent Price.
Yes.
That was easily the worst.
No, no, that
the
was
worst
good.
One that
I wouldn't even.
Wait, I could do it better. I'm not gonna right now, but I will.
No, that was impressive.
I am gonna floor you with this one.
I just see Sammy do that Price.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But go ahead.
Go ahead. No, no.
I was just going to say that another bad move. Here's a pro tip. If you're going to wear one of those masks, don't wear a fucking turtleneck with it.
No.
Unbelievable.
You know, the minute that you see the actors dancing in the mask with those fashions on them, I instantly link this movie up with Godzilla versus the Smog Monster.
Never seen it.
And oh, really? Oh, no, that's right. You haven't seen too many Godzilla movies. But yeah, there's that the whole thing with them being in like a you know, hip club, and there's people wearing animal masks and dancing and all that kind of shit. It links up immediately with this in my head.
You know what this reminded me? This may seem like a really bizarre link or a through line, but like Rocky Horror Picture Show, in some ways, I don't know. I don't know if it's just the era. What year was Rocky? Like 77 or something? Is it early?
It would have been around there, yeah.
I don't know. I just feel like by that time you started to get people looking back with reverence at sort of the macabre and the horror films of a bygone era, you know, mad scientists and things like that. So
the nostalgia cycle is always 20 years off, right? I mean, yeah. Happy Days was just set in the 50s and was made in the 70s.
Because you get the guys that grew up with that stuff 90s. Old enough sure. to make the stuff then, right?
Exactly, yeah. Uh-huh.
So what is this? Oh, I love the monster genealogy chart that Price explains to Carradine, just looking at all the different kinds of monsters and stuff. And then it leads us into when I realized that this clearly is an anthology. The Shad... What
is it? Shadmock.
It's Shadmock, kind of an unfortunate name. Raven the Shadmock, who's played by James Lawrenson, is that correct?
I believe so, yeah. I
think that's his name. Let me look. Anyway, I want to give it up to him. The laundry sin. Yeah, that's him. So he was born in New Zealand. You did Pink Floyd's The Wall, Boney, not Boney M, and some other stuff. I think he's wonderful in the film. Really wonderful in the film. And this is where we also get Simon Ward.
Yep.
The Alain Delon. I got to say, too, I feel like European horror films, you know, Hammer, and even looking at Spain, I feel like between England and Spain, a lot of the European horror stuff kept up sort of the monsters and the nods to classic monsters and the classic monster formula a lot longer than we did domestically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially with guys like you in Spain, Paul Naschy.
Naschy stuff,
huge. Yeah. I mean, that's the entirety of his filmography is pretty much paying homage to classic monster movies, the Universal horror movies.
Yeah, big time, right? And then, of course, between that and England, maybe ramping up the sleaze and stuff a little bit more
cleavage, yeah.
A little bit more cleavage, but even still, you know, a lot of that Euro horror stuff, you know, Hammer and Amicus and stuff, definitely. Was in that world. I'll tell you what, there's a cat in this story that looks like it's on the prowl. That fucking cat wasn't catching shit. Like, that cat looked so slow. There's no way that cat really got anything. It couldn't have. It just looks like such a slow cat. Like, that needs...
He wanted no fucking parts.
He wants Purina. He doesn't want a mouse. He doesn't have the time. He doesn't have the energy to get a mouse. Or the first step isn't quick enough. This is where I was talking about production values. The castle here looks pretty good, all things considered.
Well, it's authentic enough, and mm-hmm. you certainly believe the setting and how it fits the character, certainly.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that it's not like you get an exterior of a castle, and then it's just something dressed up with sort of painted gray walls. It mm-hmm. looks the part. It is the part. Now, because I think this story, the lead into it is telling us about the Shadmock, which the Shadmock is sort of like
ghoul. It's a ghoul mixed with vampire,
something like that. But what is a ghoul? What is a ghoul again? What does they say?
Ghouls. I don't remember what he says.
Ghoulhood.
Well, ghouls are basically they rob graves and eat the dead flesh.
So then it's mixed with like a vampire or something, but.
Yeah, I mean that's the whole
necessity for ghouls. Is that?
No. I think that in this cinematic world the rules are kind of fluid, or fluid enough to fit our stories.
Yes. Okay, that's fair. But we get sort of a very kind of elegant Eyes Wide Shut. Well, at least I'm always reminded of Eyes Wide Shut whenever I see these kind of masks and sort of tuxedos and ball. Like mask a ball. Like a masquerade, well, right?
The first thing that I thought of was Polanski's Fearless Vampire Killers.
Well, there you go. There you go. And I feel like, too, especially with this story, but I feel like all the stories, the way they're lit, it's not very intrusive. Like a lot of them almost feel candlelit or like a campfire tale, which I have to think that was intentional because that's
absolutely,
you know, storytelling essentially, yes. Right?
Well, that's the whole, that's the entirety of the film is, you know, it's telling stories, from the very first scene, the whole point of Carradine's character, how that leads into his little relationship with Price. And then the three stories themselves are, little more than fairy tales. I mean, the first one right off, is pretty much Beauty and the Beast, right? I mean,
yes. Good. So call. I didn't connect the dots. That's a very good point. Very good point. I also feel like Lawrenson, to me, this might have been just me reading too far into it, or it could very well have been intentional, but he looks to me like Lon Chaney Jr.
He does a little bit, yeah. Yeah, he looks a little bit like Chaney from Phantom.
That's exactly what I thought. Yeah, exactly what I thought.
He does it naturally. I mean, all he really has on him, this is not an elaborate makeup. It's basically, pale makeup and dark around the eyes is the majority of what the makeup is. And then how he parts his hair, basically. And that's it.
That's right. And I love I think it's Price that we get the line from, there's nothing sadder than the grief of
a Shadmock.
The grief of a Shadmock, yeah.
There's nothing sadder.
Oh, no, he says, there's nothing sadder than the grief of a tender-hearted monster. That's what he says, and we get Dat Shadmock.
The whistle.
Lamenting love that did him wrong, man.
Well, he's, he does come off a bit desperate. It's very innocent.
It is very innocent. And I think it comes from a pretty pure place. Like, he's not trying to, like,
Yeah, you can't help but feel bad for him,
Well, yeah. You think this guy's options are limited. It's not like Tinder for monsters, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's almost like Far From Heaven for monsters. Far From Hell, maybe they'd call it. I don't know.
Close to Hell.
Close to Hell. But there's no Richard Gere character. Oh, yeah, I guess there is. The Delon, the Simon Ward. But he's not as comfortable as Richard Gere. Then we get Vienna Blood, a place where this by Johann Strauss, which I want to say oddly shows up in Her Vengeance as well.
I think it does, man.
There's one part when I heard it.
Honestly don't remember.
Pretty sure. Anyway, you know what? I thought that it did, but.
No, that's all right. The other thing that this segment does is it sets up, the whole movie is setting up the differences and similarities between humans and monsters. Mm-hmm. Because the monsters in the movie, almost to a man, are not necessarily the bad guys.
That's right. And we see sort of at the end when there's that
little monologue.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. Gosh, I got to kind of tear through this here. More crash zooms in the second story than in any kind of Japanese spy film from the 60s or Italian film of the time. Like, it gets pretty intense. It's a little, no way approves of that choice. It just keeps going in and out. And then a lot of kind of zingers, of course, from Price when someone says, oh, he's a vampire film producer. Aren't they all?
Aren't they all?
Yep. Yes. It's fantastic. The boys' school, what a fucking jungle.
Yep.
I mean, really, Pleasance, this is when Pleasance shows up. And Pleasance, he's the leader of the B squad, which they go around staking vampires. And
yep.
I guess, go ahead.
He tells the kid, he walks up to the little kid and he says, I'm not a stranger, I'm a clergyman. Yeah. And then he gives him candy, which, today would be, holy fuck, they'd be hauling him off.
Yeah, no can do. Brit, short mom hair in this, still good, still Brit. Yep. The B squad, they're much more dour and stiff than the monster squad.
Yes. Much more. Yeah. Yeah, well, they're basically it's almost a gangster segment. It's like a lampoon of a gangster film.
Yep.
For the most part, beware of men carrying violin cases.
I like
the guys
that touch.
The guys all dressed in black. But it's what has it got? It's a dark comedy. This segment is much more dark comedy than any of the other segments, really, but it's almost verging on broad.
Mm-hmm.
But it's it's very tongue in cheek. The whole movie is tongue in cheek for the most part. But this segment much more amped up because the kid's dad is a vampire, which they pretty much it's not a secret. And then it just kind of goes from there. He's told never talk to anybody, beware of men carrying violin cases, and of course the kid fucks up and does all of that stuff.
You gotta listen to your parents.
Oh yeah.
Right.
That was a lesson learned.
Lesson learned. Almost a hard lesson learned if it wasn't for that vest.
you do get a nice little callback to Wake and Fright with Pleasance there.
Mm.
The coins on the eyes.
Mm-hmm. And I love that. When he gets his comeuppance, just mm-hmm. the hypocrisy from his character is pretty
funny. Uh-huh.
Pretty funny. I like that.
And that kind of stiff upper lip kind of, be reasonable, Gov, kind of.
Yes.
From his partners.
Yeah. Third story has a Huel, I guess. Huel? What are they, part ghoul, part human?
The unfortunately named Hume-goo. Human ghoul, which of course we find out at the beginning that when humans and monsters interbreed, it never is a good thing.
Yeah, when they hit the skins, man. And this is where Stuart Whitman shows up.
Yep.
And he's in a grubby, grimy village reminiscent of Gymkhana in Parmistan.
Yep. For the longest time, I remembered this segment when he gets to the village as being in black and white, and it's not. It's just really – it looks black and white almost.
Yeah.
It's so devoid of color. It's really so moody. Color.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's a good-looking village.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, as far as like moody, barren, kind of mucky villages go.
Yeah,
no, absolutely. There, but
well,
probably doing its job then, I guess. There's a nice callback. I mean, I'm sure Texas Chainsaw Massacre wasn't the first piece of art or storytelling to use this convention or this little twist, but there's a nice call to that with Whitman's character. The old reverse or the trick, you know, I don't know, I don't want to say too much, but not that it's really a spoiler, but it's like a boomerang for Whitman. He's like a boomerang. Man, how about the cumbersome teeth on, like, the werewolf at the Monster Club?
Oh, my God, the poor bastard. And he's trying to talk through it. He's trying to, like, deliver a lot more dialogue than you would think they would have given him.
A lot of dialogue, a lot of fur. He must have been hot as hell. Unbelievable. So you talked about the humans are being the most sort of deadly monster of all kind of thing, which, you know, again, great telling for the time, I think. And Price, you know, obviously, obvious statement, but he's just so effortlessly charming. I wished he was in it more, but again, with it, them sort of being the bookends or sort of the interspersed scenes in between all of the stories, you know, it's bound to be expected. But he's just so watchable. Mm-hmm. And that's it. That's what I got.
All right. Well, I haven't really got too much more to add to this. You get that this is very much more aimed at the young audience, especially with the rock and roll. Cause there's, you know, interspersed between each of the songs, there's like full songs, including one that's, you know, where I think it's called I'm a Stripper or something like that, where the chick's singing. And we get somebody in the Monster Club actually stripping down tastefully, right down to the you know, bare bones. But that's
my bare bone.
But it's almost these segments then give it almost like a variety TV show kind of structure and feel, and it really just kind of it gives a little bit of a different flavor as opposed to what you might normally get. You know, it's a little bit for the kids. It's a little bit more for you know, just a more I wouldn't say mature, but family oriented. Audience, because, you know, adults can enjoy it as much as kids could, as much as, you know, anybody. Really, the only additions that I would make to what you already said is that in the third segment, you do get some nice synth score going on. Backing up, you do get at a couple of times. There are it's filmed within a film in here.
Yeah, there is Stuart Whitman. He's a filmmaker, right?
Yep. He's a filmmaker. He's looking for a place to shoot his film, and you know, the segment starts off with him shooting a scene from his horror movie. The same way that you had the vampire producer, you know, getting up on stage and showing people his latest thing, and then the story becomes that, you know, what he's showing them. So it's a nice little touch, and again, it's about telling stories, right? So that's, you know, it adds into that whole theme, which I think is, you know, probably one of the most, if not the most prevalent in the entire film. And I think that, you know, that gives this a little bit more, I wouldn't say legitimacy, but a little more meat on the bone, as it were. There's a flashback. In that segment where we switch over to animation, to art, which I thought was a nice little touch.
Yes.
In the Stuart Whitman segment, the twist is a little goofy, to be perfectly honest, but it's nice. And then at the very end, you have, you know, for those of you who have been, you know, chomping at the bit to watch Vincent Price and John Carradine get down, you get that opportunity here. That's pretty much all I have to add to it. I mean, like I said, I mean, this is really it's a love story, a love letter to monsters and monster kids, and that's pretty much the entirety of it. I can't make it more plain than that. So I'll kick it over to you for MBTs and such.
Excellent. Make a Break is the finale of the first story.
Okay.
I really liked that. I thought it was really well done. And Lawrence.
It's very EC.
Yeah, it totally is. I love that reveal. There's, you know, very EC. You know, there's a price to be paid. Mm-hmm. But I love Lawrence, and I love also just how heartfelt and how much sympathy you have for his character. At least I did.
Okay.
And he's also my MBT, Lawrenson.
Okay.
I really loved him in the film. I could have went with Price, but that's no brainer. I'm sure the odds of me being able to give it to Lawrenson again are few and far between.
Yes.
But Price, it's a pretty safe bet. And my score for this is a 6.75 out of 10.
Ah, okay.
Very
nice.
Pleasant, good time. This one I could show the kids, you know.
Yep.
It's not, you know, needlessly cruel or anything, but it's fun, you know. There's a little bit of punch to it. It's good. It's very good.
Yeah. My make or break is the opening introduction between Carradine and Price. It sets the flavor for the whole film for me. So, you know, that very arch theatrical sort of quality to it, not only in the way that it looks, but in how the actors are approaching the material. So you know right off the bat what you're getting into. The appetizer is giving you what the meal's gonna, you know, taste like. And the MVT for me is just the lighthearted, gleeful celebration of monsters that this thing is. I love that. I love that it makes no bones about it, literally. And it just, you know, it embraces it. It embraces it wholeheartedly. And I mean, you're either going to want to go along with that or you're not. And my score for this is 6.5 out of 10. So.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I came in higher than you.
How about that?
Huh, interesting. I'm glad we were pretty much right there. Okay, cool. Let's take a short break. And let's come back. Let's fast forward 7 years. We're going to go around the globe to feverish, garbagey, kind of gross, sweaty revenge and insanity from Hong Kong with some Category 3 deliciousness, Her Vengeance, Nam Nai Choi. We will be right back. Something that you should all be part of if you're not. I'm going to try to start engaging more again with the community as much as we can. I threw, you know, 7 or 8 titles out there. There was a vote. This one was pretty far in front. I think the second choice was the newest film.
Is it Ragoff? I don't know.
That's a good... Kashyap's new film, what's it called? It's on Netflix. Fuck, my memory's getting worse as I get older. The new Kashyap film, it's called Raman Raghav 2.0.
Yeah, that's it.
Very good filmmaker. He's been on the show before. We covered Ugly, and I think we covered... I don't know if we covered Gangs of Wasseypur, but high recommend for me. Actually, and I also covered... I want to cover one that he wrote on The Midnight Ride. So, anyway. Yeah. The audience, the community voted for this one. Nam Nai Choi's Her Vengeance. Both of us... I believe you'd seen it before, or...
No. I just had a copy of it I was sitting on.
Nice. Glad you can finally pull that one out from under your ass now.
Ooh, buddy.
Yeah.
Got a little swampy there.
A little swampy, a little cumbersome. That's a It's a well-made disc.
I think it fits with the film.
I think it does. So yeah, I'll synopsize this. I'm a big fan of this film. It's kind of, you know, Category 3 Hong Kong bonkers version of Ms. 45 in some ways. It's kind of a simple sell. I think, you know what, this synopsis is terrible. I'm going to say it's a female rape revenge Category 3 film from Hong Kong.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, it's got a great cast. Let's hear what you have to say about it.
Well, let's see. Like you were saying, it's, you know, the comparison to Ms. 45 for me is a thin one outside of just the general rape and revenge theme. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't really have the same sort of character in the person of Chie Ying. Well, we'll just call her Ying, who is the main character, and the film jumps right into it with some can-can action at the casino that she works at in Macau, yep. I want to say.
Which is like the Vegas for a lot of people in Hong Kong.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, you get a little bit of can-can action, but then we jump over to the jerks who we know are going to cause all the trouble, with some melancholy sax music going on there. And they're just kind of riding along, I think, in pedicabs.
Yep.
They, you know, just kind of being assholes. They push their way to the front row at the casino. One of them is kind enough to call Ying an apple polisher, which I wasn't 100% sure I knew what the hell was going on with
maybe,
that.
Maybe, you know, as a, like a farmer, like a country bumpkin maybe.
Okay. Okay. Well, I was thinking more like somebody who like gives an apple to their teacher. Although I don't know if they do that in China. Yeah, I couldn't tell you. I thought it was, you know, just kind of a kiss ass thing. But when it clicked in my head, it didn't make any sense really. So I just wrote it down. Sure. There's the goatee guy in the bad guy group who's just all menace. He's too cool to be like hanging out with the rest of them.
Of course, yeah.
One of the first things that stood out to me as interesting in the film is the walk home. The fatal quote unquote walk home as she's, you know, leaving the casino after she's pissed off these guys, because it keeps the bad guys in the shadows in the background, and even, you know, there's a reflection of one of them in the mirror of a scooter, and it's not a long build up. But these little touches are nice, you know, just that menace kind of creeping in, gonna get you. They drag her off to the graveyard where we get the first, kind of brutal little brutal scene in the film. And the version that I watched was a quote-unquote uncut version, so the quality of the film switches to much more degraded in this part. But I think that it's important for the movie to have this scene in it.
Yeah.
Because it's not titillating at all. No. And I don't think you get more than the suggestion of her nudity in there. I mean, you see her being naked, but it's never like, you know, focus on her nipples or focus on, you know, her bush or whatever. You don't get that. She's naked. You see these things, but it's not
ugly and repulsive.
Exactly. And these guys are pretty, it's pretty nasty about it. It also, during the scene, you get cuts to the various statuary in the cemetery, along with a mausoleum with a giant lit cross on it, which kind of dwells on for a little while. And I'm kind of thinking to myself, okay, you're looking up there for a little bit of help from God, and it's like nothing. You're getting from this.
Which is an interesting touch from a film from Hong Kong. You know, you sometimes see faith. I mean, you see more Eastern faith come in sometimes with Wu's work and other filmmakers, but you don't see a lot of Christianity or Catholicism or iconography pertaining to that in
It could have just not in Chinese film, but it could have just been an easy touchstone that was, you know, available as much as anything else, right?
But it had to be intentionally. I don't know. I feel like it had to be intentionally put in there because I don't see.
I think it was intentional. I think it was intentional. I don't know necessarily that it was intentionally Christian, other than maybe. I mean, I don't know if Nam Nai Choi is at all a Christian guy or even interested in that sort of thing. I couldn't tell you.
That he was. Maybe I'm mixing him up.
I mean, I know Wu is.
Yeah.
Which is kind of why he sticks to that so much.
Yeah, I don't know.
I thought that was a nice little despair kind of moment for the character. It really kind of nails it home. No pun intended. You get the the bathroom scene when she goes back to work with the, and she goes with the mirror into the bathroom. I thought it was just unsettling. But that leads into one of the weirder scenes in the film, which is when she goes to see a doctor about what's going on with her downstairs, and he's pretty fast with the diagnosis of AIDS, which weirdly it changes from that to gonorrhea later on. But he also has the worst bedside manner in the world.
He does.
He yells at her for having VD, and then he's like clinging to her legs to try and get her to stay and get treated, even though he just told her, well, you can't afford it, but you know, we're going to cure you. And so,
you know what's funny about that scene? I read it I've only seen this film maybe two or three times. Mm-hmm. The first few times I'd seen it, I took it as just kind of like a kind of gross, buffoonish.
That's exactly the way that I took it.
Tone deaf.
Well, I wouldn't say tone deaf, but certainly just out of place.
It is out of place, and by being out of place, it's very in place for a Category 3 film.
The way
they collide together and humor can be very insensitive at times. But then this time, the way I read it was, I wonder if this is just more commentary on the predatory kind of leering nature of men. And
very much, yeah.
You know, when it was just more, well, you have this and you have that, and just clearly she doesn't. But it was just more, you know, the nature of the repulsive kind of nature of men in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
She can't rely on even someone that you would hope you could rely on or trust, which is a doctor.
Yes. Yeah. No. Exactly. That's absolutely in there, I think. You have Ying's blind sister who sees all.
Hang on 1 second here. You keep talking.
Ooh, there's some moaning going on there, buddy. But what happens then is when we meet Ying's sister, who, like I said, is blind. You get a little bit of backstory as to the guys who raped Ying and their connection with their family, which runs a little bit deeper than you might at first expect, which is very much a coincidence. And it's one of those coincidences that it works enough for what it needs to do. Although, you know, I've always heard the rule of thumb is one coincidence is all you're really allowed in a film. Mm-hmm. This has a few, but I was just talking about how the rapists have a certain connection to Ying's family.
Yes.
Which
that really ramps up the hate quotient for the audience.
Yep. It really does. You get the worst meet cute ever between Ying and what the hell is this? Did he even have a name? I probably wrote it down somewhere.
Lam Ching Ying's character?
Her
sort of boyfriend.
Kelvin.
Kelvin Wong Su is credited as Ying's sort of boyfriend.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
There you go.
You get the worst little meet cute ever with those two, where she just kind of runs into him and then runs away. There's no law in this film to go back into the theme that's going on between, you know, you can't trust or lean on anybody. Bad guys aren't scared of them anyway, and the good guys can't count on them. You know, there's no, and I don't think we even see a cop in this, do we?
No, and I think that's another thing is just how curiously absent the quote unquote good guys are, other than a few, but even the good guys in this have been exploited and abused over the years. Right.
Well, you get, I mean, when Ying stays over at Kelvin's place, you know, he ogles her up while she's sleeping. So, you know, you get that little dance between the Category 3 elements and the rest of the, you know, what's going on with the film. But he does cover her up, so he still is like the nice guy. But at the same time, he's, you know, he's totally eyeing her ass, and the camera does as well to give us the Cat 3 rating. A little bit of titillation. She goes to a bar following one of the guys, and you get a wonderful little mistaken identity scene, which is just over the top. She goes at him with a smash bottle, which is great. And this is when we finally get Nam Nai Choi showing up, and he's just not fucking happy to see her at all. As a matter of fact, I don't think he betrays a single emotion the entire movie. He's made of stone. He makes Gordon Mitchell, you know, kind of look like Charles Nelson Reilly. So just to give you a little bit of an analogy there. But he's, you know, he really, you know, that he's the guy as soon as you see him, you know, that he's the guy who's going to be bringing it and be the hard ass that kind of, you know, brings it all together. Let's see. There's the idea in the Choi character about, you know, cripples, not only between him, but as well as Ying, which that was probably the worst sentence I've ever said on air. The ideas of, you know, cripples, emotional and physical, not being whole, and, you know, they're without closure. They can't be whole without closure / vengeance, right? So you get that here. You get the banana in the tailpipe ploy going on.
I haven't seen that.
We're not going to fall for the banana in the tailpipe. So they did, unfortunately. You get some clown puking down the side of his car, and then she starts to lay into these guys after she, you know, meets up with Nam Nai Choi. And it goes from there. The ways that she starts trying to pick these guys, and the one guy just gets fucking pommeled. Like every time she meets up with him, she just does more damage to him. And the poor bastard just, you know, getting nothing. He gets acid in his face. He gets all kinds of shit. You have one guy burning a loose string off the crotch of his pants, which is never a good idea, especially if they're made out of polyester. I'm just saying, that's, you know, pro tip. You get the "nothing good will ever come of this" lecture from Nam Nai Choi, even though you know that, you know where he's going to go down. You know what road he's going to go down with this thing. There's a scene in there where I felt like we were supposed to be watching characters engaging in underage porn. When they get to a guy by the name of Big Charlie, who's one of the rapists, and it's really skanky, that scene, because they, you know, they're in this place that is just wall to wall women being groped, and I would even hesitate to call them women. I mean, they look like girls being groped and everything else, and, you know, clearly either drugged or drunk or both. And then, you know, he starts filming you know, porn with them, and it just this really, really ramped up the whole category 3 element to it. Okay. You get the blind sister who just is hardcore when she meets up with the rapist. You know, they're going to make it more personal as the movie goes on. You get some great wheelchair stunts from Choi. You get the one guy is running around barefoot on Hong Kong streets, which is just another bad idea. Move. Man, all the shit you could step on. Oof. Just on a regular street. But then you always just kind of think, when you're watching a movie like this, for how grotty it is, that there's got to be just all kinds of, like, needles and razor blades and shit. Broken glass everywhere. Yeah. You get the booby trap / A-team montage.
That's great.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it comes with its own set of hot licks.
Oh, man, there are some serious hot licks in that scene.
Fuck, yes, there are.
I mean, they get heavy.
Oh, yeah, big time. And then the ending just – it absolutely goes for it. It goes for, you know, balls to the fucking wall, and it delivers. So that's the majority of what I got to say about it, man. I mean I really dug this a lot more I expected to like it, but I liked it a lot more than even that expectation was. So, you know, good deal.
Nice. Okay, I won't spend a ton of time just because we're pinched for time. But, yeah, Rape Revenge, you know, thankfully that kind of ugly subgenre is kind of dying. It, you know, looking back at it now, it's rough stuff.
Well, it's always had a very hard balancing act to try and pull off, right?
It does, and especially... So here's what I think the biggest strength of this. I think there's three things that elevate this from being, because this could have been completely, I mean, and enjoyable if you're going to distance yourself from the elements, but this could have been a completely tasteless fucking sleaze fest. However, three things elevate it for me. Number one, Nam Nai Choi is an excellent, excellent filmmaker.
Yep.
Number two, Lam Ching Ying is, for my money, one of the maybe three or four best all-around actors in Hong Kong, tragically taken from us far too young. I think he's about 44, 45. Because one of his the biggest things I've always appreciated about him is how graceful he is, the humanity, sort of a kindness and a class and a dignity to everything he does. Whether it's the prodigal son, whether it's Mr. Vampire, I mean, whatever he does, there's a grace and a humanity and a class to it.
Now wait, which character was Lam Ching Ying?
He was the wheelchair bound like the mentor.
Oh, wow. Oh God, I thought that shows you how stupid I am. I thought that was Nam Nai Choi in there. Oh no,
it's Lam Ching Ying. That's Lam Ching.
Jesus, I've been calling him Choi the whole damn time. Ugh.
It's okay. It's all good. Was that his name in the film? What was his name in the film?
Xiong.
It was Xiong. So that's all. It's all good. So yeah, he's one of my favorites. I mean, he's just great, man. He's great and tremendously talented physically. Now, second to him is our lead, Pauline Wong, and she's great in the film. She's an actress that I've always liked. I've always found her, you know, pretty, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I like her, but I have a thing for women with more pronounced noses. She kind of reminds me a little bit of Bridget Lin, a little bit.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, a little bit. Is it Bridget Lin I'm thinking of? No. I'm thinking of, oh gosh. No, I'm going to do it.
I thought of Kara Hoy.
I'm thinking of Anita Hui, I think.
Anita
Hui? Man, this is getting terrible. Anita Mui. Good Lord, it's too early for this. I've been up since 4:30. Anita Hui. Anita Mui is who I was thinking of. I'm a big fan of Anita Mui.
Well, she's
also sadly taken from us too.
Did she pass on? Yeah, I was going to say
too young as well.
I was going to compare with what you were saying about the nose to Kara Hoy, who was in the Shaw Brothers.
Shaw Brothers. For sure. But yeah, Anita Mui is who I was thinking of. But yeah, I think Pauline Wong's good actress again. There's a sort of tender kind of dignity to her. She's not, and again, you talk about the fine balance in these kind of films. As much as someone is as terribly put upon as someone in her role, if they're shrieky and over the top too much, you begin to tune them out. And she, I think, balances a sort of a tender determination, and it works wonderfully. So those three strengths really, really elevate this film for me. And I think the fact that Nam Nai Choi is a great visual filmmaker, you know, in that you get someone like Choi Hawk, who is very strong with cinematography, and Nam Nai Choi actually shot a bunch of films too. So I think that you really get to see that in this film. You get to see some stylistic flourishes that you don't normally get to see from Category 3 stuff. Our gang of rapists are pretty awful, but it's kind of a, you know, great kind of character actor cast. Hong Yi-sang, Billy Choi, great Canadian Hong Kong actor who's got, you know, great filmography. Eastern Condors, Dragons Forever, Fist of Legend. You know, he did a ton of films. So you get a really great cast of heavies alongside. And then Cheng Ging, great character actor. Usually, I don't know if I've ever seen him without a mustache. He's the acid face.
Yeah. Dude.
So, yeah, you know, great kind of cast. Hong Kong, sort of 80s neon, I always love seeing in films. Because they really loved Hong Kong really loved neon.
You almost have to wonder, the way that these films were not preserved, you know, whether or not you would actually want to see them cleaned up, you know, pristine, like something like a you know, 4K restoration of the thing or something. Would you want to? Would it have the same, you know, would that take away from...
I think it depends.
Part
I think
of the,
like this, it might enhance it because there are the technical aspects were more closely paid attention to than your normal kind of down and dirty Category 3 film.
Well, no, I'm just talking about the texture of it, not necessarily, you know, the...
I'd be game for it still. I would. Anytime a film can look better is never a bad thing for me. Yeah. Even something like Things, the Canadian film. even that on Blue is fine by me. But, you know, it's a shame, I think, that a lot of their films weren't well taken care of in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
The gang of rapists in this, like they're almost like a juvenile bunch of kind of cartoonish pirates in a way.
Yep.
They're so gross and so over the top. Like,
Well, they're the kind of guys who sit there and cackle at everything that they do, like it's the funniest fucking thing in the world. And you're like, what the fuck are you laughing at?
Like the
if you hung out with guys like that, you'd be like, you know, get the fuck away from me.
Those guys, yeah, they'd be dead. Those guys would be dead.
Yeah.
Very cool. Or they'd be in jail. Like mm-hmm. Those kind of guys cannot be on the streets for very long. Yeah, they're just very ugly and gross, gross human beings. You mentioned about the cross and all that stuff. You mentioned about the doctor. There's a moment when the scene gets saturated with red, almost like a giallo, and then it goes blue.
Yeah, yeah.
Choi Hawk from. So
that's right. That's right around when she meets Kelvin.
Yes, exactly. So you know that's cool. Again, not something you normally see in films from Hong Kong of the time. What did I write here? Five villains. Oh, I can't say that. That's a spoiler. This is where I thought I heard Johann Strauss's Vienna Blood again. So kind of funny that both films would have it, if in fact my hearing is what I thought it was. I think the elements work well to enhance the film as well, too. Like, you could maybe say over the top, but this is an over the top film. Like, the rain really, like, our lead is really put upon in this film. She's put through the ringer.
Oh, yeah.
And when she gets sort of this quiet kind of humanity of Lam Ching Ying to help her, it works wonders, but the rain and every the elements really, really work against her. There was a line I wrote down. I think one of the girls, one of the other showgirls at the cabaret, says that basically her job is to play dumb and be regularly ravaged.
Yeah,
terrible existence. Oh, when I think when someone gets what's coming to them in the bar at that scene, he goes, no, it was just a misunderstanding. That understatement. Misunderstanding. And you mentioned the banana in the tailpipe. Our girl's acid wash denim game is strong.
Ooh.
Which is good. There's a great line when one of the characters is eating fish balls and the girl walks up and says, taking fish balls alone? There's another way to take them, man.
I wasn't going to mention the fish balls. It might have been going too far.
Good old fish balls.
Oh, yeah. Got to put them in your mouth.
Yeah. They're not bad, actually. They're not bad.
I never had – well, I'm assuming they're not actual balls.
No.
They're like
a chicken ball.
Balls of fish. Yeah, they're balls of fish. They're not fish's balls. Right.
I don't know how big or filling or
satisfying. Those would be pretty – those if those are fish's balls, man, then those are some big fucking fish.
The clackers on the grouper or something.
The kerbangers.
Yeah, man. The George Eastman of fish. I love when she goes into revenge mode, and it really like it's almost like she inhabits like a bride wore black. Man, my memory is getting so bad. It's cartoonish.
That's why I write everything down.
Not Simone Signore. What's her name? Oh, good lord. This is awful. Jean Moreau. The way she has that cool seduction. And she kind of calmly and coolly says to the guy when she ties him up, you raped me, I'll rape you.
Mm-hmm.
And she says in this very hushed, kind of calm.
But he's into it at first.
At first he is, until he gets his ear cut off with a pair of scissors. And And she yells, Pokai! Which is like the great Cantonese cuss word. And how about that flimsy windshield, man?
Oh, buddy. Yeah,
he wasn't like Thunderkick, and that thing crumbled. I just love even some of the throwaway stuff, the way Nam Nai Choi shoots his stuff. Like there's a fruit market kind of scene where like we get someone gets killed, and there's like these bloody pears just kind of rolling along the ground, and the camera shooting it low, and really good stuff. I love the bag of tricks that they come up with. Like you talked about the scene when it's almost like Home Alone, when they're like they're booby trapping.
Mm-hmm.
The place. It's really great. It's really great. And, you know, this does, I think, walk that line of, or the sort of that mantra of an eye for an eye leaves both people blind.
Yes.
You know what I thought was amazingly done? And I think a lot of Hong Kong films of the time, Category 3 films, wouldn't have given a shit to, like, to even do this, but they pull it off really well, is Nam Nai Choi's character is... he's in a wheelchair, and he is from the legs down, like from the basically above the knees down, he has no legs.
Yeah.
The scene when you see him get out of
his wheelchair
into bed, that's really well edited and like some really good cinematic sleight of hand.
Yeah, no, it's very well done. Very well done.
Yeah.
And you called him Nam Nai Choi too, so
now I don't feel so bad. Did I just call him Nam Nai Choi? Lam Ching Ying.
Yeah, buddy.
Fuck. Lam Ching Ying. No, I said the way Nam Nai Choi shot it, didn't I?
No.
Oh, wow.
I don't think he did. Well, maybe I'm... Maybe
we'll find out when the episode comes out.
Oh, God.
And that's such a crass, vulgar line from one of the rapists. He's a rapist, of course. He says, I made love with all girls except a blind one. Fucking gross, dude. I love the scene. A really, again, powerful scene with the blind sister frantically flailing with the knife.
Yep.
A really impressive stunt there, too.
Yeah.
Fulci wouldn't have been able to do that as convincingly.
With
the dummy.
Uh-huh.
This was well edited. Like that was a seamless cut. Like
it was very well. Yeah, and that goes back to the Lam Ching Ying.
Lam Ching Ying
scene when he takes up. Yeah.
I thought you meant Nam Nai Choi. Fuck, who's on?
No, when he's getting out of the wheelchair.
Yeah, beautifully edited. Beautifully edited.
Yeah.
I love the line from I think it's Lam Ching Ying when he says, "This is a villain's world."
He probably did. I don't remember.
Really great shots of some skyscrapers, some exterior shots of Hong Kong that are nice.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing wheelchair training montage.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, yeah. Fungus soup. No, thank you. What else do we got here? You mentioned the hot licks during the booby trapping montage.
Mm-hmm.
This comes in less than 90 minutes. We get a really painful scene with some dried chilies. And fish hooks.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Man. And that guy, he legit screams. And hopefully so. That would be awful.
I don't know which would be worse.
Oof. And I got to ask, you know, having seen that, like, I would have loved to have seen a really intense Category 3 Hong Kong version of Hellraiser.
Yeah. That would have been nice. But, God, well, you never know. Maybe there's one out there.
They would have had some sights to show us. I love the arrow shot, slow motion. It looks really good. And I love how they use like that dog catcher device to the thing around like the flexible kind of noose thing that you wrangle.
But you stick through the bamboo pole.
That's good. Yep. Stunt work's great in this. The nuts and bolts of it are great. You know, the wheelchair wheel throw is great.
Yeah.
Really good stuff. But you know, you expect that from a Hong Kong film. You know, first rate stunt work. It's brutal. That last scene is brutal. It's intense. It's cruel. It's vicious.
Satisfying.
Heartbreaking. It's all of the above. And I think that's what you want from this kind of film. So those are all my notes. Let's kick it over to you.
All right. Make or break for me is the rape scene. If you can't get through that, and like I said, it is pretty brutal, then you... really, you're not going to really care for the rest of the movie because it's the whole Magilla as far as what the film is centered on. MVT for me is Pauline Wong. I think that, you know, she really does a wonderful job at, you know, being both, innocent as well as hardcore.
Resilient.
Yeah. She shows a great amount of inner strength, throughout the picture, as well as a certain vulnerability, and you know, she does very, very well. So score for me is going to be 7 out of 10.
Nice. You went with the sort of catalyst for all of this. I went with the payoff or the finale. You really want it to pay off when someone's been as poorly done to as our leads have in this, and it pays off. It's brutal. It's nasty. And my MVT is the humanity of our two leads. I think they've worked wonderfully together. Lam Ching Ying is a gift. Gone way too soon. Pauline Wong, wonderful as well. My score is a 7.75 out of 10. I really love this film. Lam Nai Kai, as he's also known as. Or Simon Nam.
I get so confused.
Yeah. I know, it's tough sometimes. There's multiple names to try to remember for one person. He's great. You know, one of the unsung Helmers from Hong Kong. I mean, people that know, but if you don't, check out his body of work. It's really, he's almost, you can almost see like a carpenter in that he worked so well in a wide number of genres through the sort of early 80s and 90s. You know, really good stuff. And that's it. That's the big show. So we are all done. Next week we're coming back with hopefully something a little different, scheduling permitting, so I don't want to say it yet. So we'll announce it in the group. And with that being said, that leaves us with one more thing to say.
Adios.
Adios.
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com, and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com.